Orientalist philology by Massignon's studies of what he called the mystical lexicon, the vocabulary of Islamic devotion, and so on. But there is another, more interesting conjunction between Orientalism in this phase of its history and the European sciences of man, science de l'homme, the Geisteswissenschaften contemporary with it. We must note, first, that non-Orientalist cultural studies were, perforce, more immediately responsive to the threats to humanistic culture of a self-aggrandizing, amoral technical specialization represented, in part at least, by the rise of fascism in Europe. This response extended the concerns of the interwar period into the period following World War II as well. An eloquent, scholarly, and personal testimonial to this response can be found in Erich Auerbach's magisterial Mimesis and in his last methodological reflections as a philologue. He tells us that Mimesis was written during his exile in Turkey and was meant to be in large measure an attempt virtually to see the development of Western culture at almost the last moment when that culture still had its integrity and civilizational coherence. Therefore, he set himself the task of writing a general work based on specific textual analyses in such a way as to lay out the principles of Western literary performance in all their variety, richness, and fertility. The aim was a synthesis of Western culture in which the synthesis itself was matched in importance by the very gesture of doing it, which Auerbach believed was made possible by what he called late bourgeois humanism. The discrete particular was thus converted into a highly mediated symbol of the world historical process. No less important for Auerbach, and this fact is of immediate relevance to Orientalism, was the humanistic tradition of involvement in a national culture or literature not one's own. Auerbach's example was Curtius, whose prodigious output testified to his deliberate choice as a German to dedicate himself professionally to the Romance literatures. Not for nothing, then, did Auerbach end his autumnal reflections with a significant quotation from Hugo of St. Victor's Didascalicon. The man who finds his homeland sweet is still a tender beginner. He to whom every soil is as his native one is already strong, but he is perfect to whom the entire world is as a foreign land. The more one is able to leave one's cultural home, the more easily is one able to judge it, and the whole world as well, with the spiritual detachment and generosity necessary for true vision. The more easily, too, does one assess oneself and alien cultures with the same combination of intimacy and distance. No less important and methodologically formative a cultural force was the use in the social sciences of types, both as an analytical device and as a way of seeing familiar things in a new way. The precise history of the type, as it is to be found in early 20th century thinkers like Weber, Durkheim, Lukács, Mannheim, and the other sociologists of knowledge, has been examined often enough. Yet, it has not been remarked, I think, that Weber's studies of Protestantism, Judaism, and Buddhism blew him, perhaps unwittingly, into the very territory originally charted and claimed by the Orientalists. There, he found encouragement amongst all those 19th-century thinkers who believed that there was a sort of ontological difference between Eastern and Western economic, as well as religious, mentalities. Although he never thoroughly studied Islam, Weber nevertheless influenced the field considerably, mainly because his notions of type were simply an outside confirmation of many of the canonical theses held by Orientalists, whose economic ideas never extended beyond asserting the Orientals' fundamental incapacity for trade, commerce, and economic rationality. In the Islamic field, those clichés held good for literally hundreds of years, until Maxime Rodinson's important study, Islam and Capitalism, appeared in 1966. Still, the notion of a type, Oriental, Islamic, Arab, or whatever, endures and is nourished by similar kinds of abstractions or paradigms or types as they emerge out of the modern social sciences. I have often spoken in this book of the sense of estrangement experienced by Orientalists as they dealt with or lived in a culture so profoundly different from their own. Now, one of the striking differences between Orientalism in its Islamic version and all the other humanistic disciplines where Auerbach's notions on the necessity of estrangement have some validity is that Islamic Orientalists never saw their estrangement from Islam either as salutary or as an attitude with implications for the better understanding of their own culture. Rather, their estrangement from Islam simply intensified their feelings of superiority about European culture, even as their antipathy spread to include the entire Orient, of which Islam was considered a degraded and usually a virulently dangerous representative. Such tendencies, it has also been my argument, became built into the very traditions of Orientalist study throughout the 19th century, and in time became a standard component of most Orientalist training, handed on from generation to generation. In addition, I think, the likelihood was very great that European scholars would continue to see the Near Orient through the perspective of its biblical origins, that is, as a place of unshakably influential religious primacy. Given its special relationship to both Christianity and Judaism, Islam remained forever the Orientalists' idea or type of original cultural effrontery, aggravated naturally by the fear that Islamic civilization originally, as well as contemporaneously, continued to stand somehow opposed to the Christian West. For these reasons, Islamic Orientalism between the wars shared in the general sense of cultural crisis adumbrated by Auerbach and the others I have spoken of briefly, without at the same time developing in the same way as the other human sciences. Because Islamic Orientalism also preserved within it the peculiarly polemical religious attitude it had had from the beginning, it remained fixed in certain methodological tracks, so to speak. Its cultural alienation, for one, needed to be preserved from modern history and socio-political circumstance, as well as from the necessary revisions imposed on any theoretical or historical type by new data. For another, the abstractions offered by Orientalism, or rather the opportunity for making abstractions, in the case of Islamic civilization, were considered to have acquired a new validity, since it was assumed that Islam worked the way Orientalists said it did, without reference to actuality, but only to a set of classical principles. It was also assumed that modern Islam would be nothing more than a reasserted version of the old, especially since it was also supposed that modernity for Islam was less of a challenge than an insult. The very large number of assumptions and suppositions in this description, incidentally, are intended to portray the rather eccentric twists and turns necessary for Orientalism to have maintained its peculiar way of seeing human reality. Finally, if the synthesizing ambition in philology, as conceived by Auerbach or Curtius, was to lead to an enlargement of the scholar's awareness, of his sense of the brotherhood of man, of the universality of certain principles of human behavior, in Islamic Orientalism, synthesis led to a sharpened sense of difference between Orient and Occident as reflected in Islam. What I am describing, then, is something that will characterize Islamic Orientalism until the present day, its retrogressive position when compared with the other human sciences, and even with the other branches of Orientalism, its general methodological and ideological backwardness, and its comparative insularity from developments both in the other humanities and in the real world of historical, economic, social, and political circumstances. Some awareness of this lag in Islamic or Semitic Orientalism was already present towards the end of the 19th century, perhaps because it was beginning to be apparent to some observers how very little either Semitic or Islamic Orientalism had shaken itself loose from the religious background from which it originally derived. The first Orientalist Congress was organized and held in Paris in 1873, and almost from the outset it was evident to other scholars that the Semiticists and Islamicists were in intellectual arrears, generally speaking. Writing a survey of all the congresses that had been held between 1873 and 1897, the English scholar R. N. Cust had this to say about the Semitic-Islamic subfield. Such meetings, as those held in the ancient Semitic field, indeed advance Oriental learning. The same cannot be said with regard to the modern Semitic section. It was crowded, but the subjects discussed were of the smallest literary interest, such as would occupy the minds of the dilettanti scholars of the old school, not the great class of indicatores of the 19th century. I am forced to go back to Pliny to find a word. There was an absence from this section both of the modern philological and archaeological spirit, and the report reads more like that of a congress of university tutors of the last century met to discuss the reading of a passage in a Greek play, or the accentuation of a vowel, before the dawn of comparative philology had swept away the cobwebs of the scholiasts. Was it worthwhile to discuss whether Mahomet could hold a pen or write? To some extent, the polemical antiquarianism that Cust described was a scholarly version of European anti-Semitism. Even the designation modern Semitic, which was meant to include both Muslims and Jews, and which had its origin in the so-called ancient Semitic field pioneered by Renan, carried its racist banner with what was doubtless meant to be a decent ostentation. A little later in his report, Cust comments on how, in the same meeting, the Aryan supplied much material for reflection. Clearly, the Aryan is a counter-abstraction to the Semite, but for some of the reasons I listed earlier, such atavistic labels were felt to be especially pertinent to Semites, with what expensive moral and human consequences for the human community as a whole the history of the 20th century amply demonstrates. Yet, what has not been sufficiently stressed in histories of modern anti-Semitism has been the legitimation of such atavistic designations by Orientalism, and more important for my purposes here, the way this academic and intellectual legitimation has persisted right through the modern age in discussions of Islam, the Arabs, or the Near Orient. For whereas it is no longer possible to write learned or even popular disquisitions on either the Negro mind or the Jewish personality, it is perfectly possible to engage in such research as the Islamic mind or the Arab character. But of this subject more later. Thus, in order properly to understand the intellectual genealogy of interwar Islamic Orientalism, as it is most interestingly and satisfyingly seen, no irony intended, in the careers of Massignon and Gibb, we must be able to understand the differences between the Orientalist's summational attitude towards his material and the kind of attitude to which it bears a strong cultural resemblance, that in the work of philologists such as Auerbach and Curtius. The intellectual crisis in Islamic Orientalism was another aspect of the spiritual crisis of late bourgeois humanism. In its form and style, however, Islamic Orientalism viewed the problems of mankind as separable into the categories called Oriental or Occidental. It was believed, then, that for the Oriental, liberation, self-expression, and self-enlargement were not the issues that they were for the Occidental. Instead, the Islamic Orientalist expressed his ideas about Islam in such a way as to emphasize his, as well as putatively the Muslims, resistance to change, to mutual comprehension between East and West, to the development of men and women out of archaic, primitive classical institutions and into modernity. Indeed, so fierce was this sense of resistance to change, and so universal were the powers ascribed to it, that in reading the Orientalists one understands that the apocalypse to be feared was not the destruction of Western civilization, but rather the destruction of the barriers that kept East and West from each other. When Gibb opposed nationalism in the modern Islamic states, he did so because he felt that nationalism would corrode the inner structures keeping Islam Oriental. The net result of secular nationalism would be to make the Orient no different from the West. Yet it is a tribute to Gibb's extraordinarily sympathetic powers of identification with an alien religion that he put his disapproval in such a way as to seem to be speaking for the Islamic Orthodox community. How much such pleading was a reversion to the old Orientalist habit of speaking for the natives, and how much it was a sincere attempt at speaking in Islam's best interests, is a question whose answer lies somewhere between the two alternatives. No scholar or thinker, of course, is a perfect representative of some ideal type or school in which, by virtue of national origin or the accidents of history, he participates. Yet, in so relatively insulated and specialized a tradition as Orientalism, I think there is in each scholar some awareness, partly conscious and partly non-conscious, of national tradition, if not of national ideology. This is particularly true in Orientalism, additionally so because of the direct political involvement of European nations in the affairs of one or another Oriental country. The case of Snouk Hurhonje, to cite a non-British and non-French instance where the scholar's sense of national identity is simple and clear, comes to mind immediately. Yet even after making all the proper qualifications about the difference between an individual and a type, or between an individual and a tradition, it is nevertheless striking to note the extent to which Gibb and Massignon were representative types. Perhaps it would be better to say that Gibb and Massignon fulfilled all the expectations created for them by their national traditions, by the politics of their nations, by the internal history of their national schools of Orientalism. Sylvain Lévy put the distinction between the two schools trenchantly. The political interest that ties England to India holds British work to a sustained contact with concrete realities and maintains the cohesion between representations of the past and the spectacle of the present. Nourished by classical traditions, France seeks out the human mind as it manifests itself in India in the same way that it is interested in China. It would be too easy to say that this polarity results, on the one hand, in work that is sober, efficient, concrete, and on the other, in work that is universalistic, speculative, brilliant. Yet the polarity serves to illuminate two long and extremely distinguished careers that between them dominated French and Anglo-American Islamic Orientalism until the 1960s. If the domination makes any sense at all, it is because each scholar derived from and worked in a self-conscious tradition whose constraints, or limits, intellectually and politically speaking, can be described as Lévy describes them above. Gibb was born in Egypt, Massignon in France. Both were to become deeply religious men, students not so much of society as of the religious life in society. Both were also profoundly worldly. One of their greatest achievements was putting traditional scholarship to use in the modern political world. Yet the range of their work, the texture of it almost, is vastly different, even allowing for the obvious disparities in their schooling and religious education. In his lifelong devotion to the work of Al-Hallaj, whose traces, Gibb said in his obituary notice for Massignon in 1962, he never ceased to seek out in later Islamic literature and devotion. Massignon's almost unrestricted range of research would lead him virtually everywhere, finding evidence for l'esprit humain à travers l'espace et le temps. In an oeuvre that took in every aspect and region of contemporary Muslim life and thought, Massignon's presence in Orientalism was a constant challenge to his colleagues. Certainly Gibb, for one, admired, but finally drew back from, the way Massignon pursued themes that in some way linked the spiritual life of Muslims and Catholics, and enabled him to find a congenial element in the veneration of Fatima, and consequently a special field of interest in the study of Shiite thought in many of its manifestations, or again in the community of Abrahamic origins and such themes as the Seven Sleepers. His writings on these subjects have acquired from the qualities that he brought to them a permanent significance in Islamic studies. But just because of these qualities, they are composed, as it were, in two registers. One was at the ordinary level of objective scholarship, seeking to elucidate the nature of the given phenomenon by a masterly use of established tools of academic research. The other was at a level on which objective data and understanding were absorbed and transformed by an individual intuition of spiritual dimensions. It was not always easy to draw a dividing line between the former and the transfiguration that resulted from the outpouring of the riches of his own personality. There is a hint here that Catholics are more likely to be drawn to a study of the veneration of Fatima than Protestants, but there is no mistaking Gibb's suspicion of anyone who blurred the distinction between objective scholarship and one based on even an elaborate individual intuition of spiritual dimensions. Gibb was right, however, in the next paragraph of the obituary, to acknowledge Massignon's fertility of mind in such diverse fields as the symbolism of Muslim art, the structure of Muslim logic, the intricacies of medieval finance, and the organization of artisan corporations. And he was right also, immediately after, to characterize Massignon's early interest in the Semitic languages as giving rise to elliptic studies that to the uninitiate almost rivaled the mysteries of the ancient Hermetica. Nevertheless, Gibb ends on a generous note, remarking that, for us, the lesson which by his example he impressed upon the Orientalists of his generation was that even classical Orientalism is no longer adequate without some degree of committedness to the vital forces that have given meaning and value to the diverse aspects of Eastern cultures. That, of course, was Massignon's greatest contribution, and it is true that in contemporary French Islamology, as it is sometimes called, there has grown up a tradition of identifying with the vital forces informing Eastern culture. One need only mention the extraordinary achievements of scholars like Jacques Berck, Maxime Rodinson, Yves Lacoste, Roger Arnaldez, all of them differing widely among themselves in approach and intention, to be struck with the seminal example of Massignon, whose intellectual impress upon them all is unmistakable. Yet in choosing to focus his comments almost anecdotally upon Massignon's various strengths and weaknesses, Gibb misses the obvious things about Massignon, things that make him so different from Gibb, and yet, when taken as a whole, make him the mature symbol of so crucial a development within French Orientalism. One is Massignon's personal background, which quite beautifully illustrates the simple truth of Lévy's description of French Orientalism. The very idea of an esprit humain was something more or less foreign to the intellectual and religious background out of which Gibb, like so many modern British Orientalists, developed. In Massignon's case, the notion of esprit, as an aesthetic as well as religious, moral, and historical reality, was something he seemed to have been nourished upon from childhood. His family was friendly with such people as Huysmans, and in nearly everything he wrote, Massignon's early education in the intellectual ambiance, as well as the ideas of late symbolisme, is evident, even to the particular brand of Catholicism and Sufi mysticism in which he was interested. There is no austerity in Massignon's work, which is formulated in one of the great French styles of the century. His ideas about human experience draw plentifully upon thinkers and artists contemporary with him, and it is the very wide cultural range of his style itself that puts him in a different category altogether from Gibbs. His early ideas come out of the period of so-called aesthetic decadence, but they are also indebted to people like Bergson, Durkheim, and Mauss. His first contact with Orientalism came through Renan, whose lectures he heard as a young man. He was also a student of Sylvain Lévy, and came to include among his friends such figures as Paul Claudel, Gabriel Bunour, Jacques and Raïs Saint-Maritain, and Charles de Foucault. Later, he was able to absorb work done in such relatively recent fields as urban sociology, structural linguistics, psychoanalysis, contemporary anthropology, and the new history. His essays, to say nothing of the monumental study of Al-Hallaj, draw effortlessly on the entire corpus of Islamic literature. His mystifying erudition and almost familiar personality sometimes make him appear to be a scholar invented by Jorge Luis Borges. He was very sensitive to Oriental themes in European literature. This was one of Gibbs' interests, too, but unlike Gibb, Massignon was attracted primarily neither to European writers who understood the Orient, nor to European texts that were independent artistic corroborations of what later Orientalist scholars would reveal. For example, Gibbs' interest in Scott as a source for the study of Saladin. Massignon's Orient was completely consonant with the world of the Seven Sleepers, or of the Abrahamic Prayers, which are the two themes singled out by Gibb as distinctive marks of Massignon's unorthodox view of Islam. Offbeat, slightly peculiar, wholly responsive to the dazzling interpretative gifts which Massignon brought to it, and which, in a sense, made it up as a subject. If Gibb liked Scott's Saladin, then Massignon's symmetrical predilection was for Nerval, as suicide, poète maudit, psychological oddity. This is not to say that Massignon was essentially a student of the past. On the contrary, he was a major presence in Islamic French relations, in politics, as well as culture. He was obviously a passionate man who believed that the world of Islam could be penetrated, not by scholarship exclusively, but by devotion to all of its activities, not the least of which was the world of Eastern Christianity, subsumed within Islam, one of whose subgroups, the Badaliya Sodality, was warmly encouraged by Massignon. Massignon's considerable literary gifts sometimes give his scholarly work an appearance of capricious, overly cosmopolitan, and often private speculation. This appearance is misleading, and in fact is rarely adequate as a description of his writing. What he wished deliberately to avoid was what he called l'analyse analytique et statique de l'orientalisme, a sort of inert piling up on a supposed Islamic text or problem of sources, origins, proofs, demonstrations, and the like. Everywhere, his attempt is to include as much of the context of a text or problem as possible, to animate it, to surprise his reader almost with the glancing insights available to anyone who, like Massignon, is willing to cross disciplinary and traditional boundaries in order to penetrate to the human heart of any text. No modern Orientalist, and certainly not Gibb, his closest peer in achievement and influence, could refer so easily and accurately in an essay to a host of Islamic mystics and to Jung, Heisenberg, Mallarmé, and Kierkegaard. And certainly, very few Orientalists had that range together with the concrete political experience of which he was able to speak in his 1952 essay L'Occident devant l'Orient. Primauté d'une solution culturelle. And yet, his intellectual world was a clearly defined one. It had a definite structure, intact from the beginning to the end of his career, and it was laced up, despite its almost unparalleled richness of scope and reference, in a set of basically unchanging ideas. Let us briefly describe the structure and list the ideas in a summary fashion. Massignon took as his starting point the existence of the three Abrahamic religions, of which Islam is the religion of Ishmael, the monotheism of a people excluded from the divine promise made to Isaac. Islam is therefore a religion of resistance to God the Father, to Christ the Incarnation, which yet keeps within it the sadness that began in Hagar's tears. Arabic, as a result, is the very language of tears, just as the whole notion of jihad in Islam, which Massignon explicitly says is the epic form in Islam that Renan could not see or understand, has an important intellectual dimension, whose mission is war against Christianity and Judaism as exterior enemies, and against heresy as an interior enemy. Yet within Islam, Massignon believed he was able to discern a type of counter-current, which it became his chief intellectual mission to study, embodied in mysticism, a road towards divine grace. The principal feature of mysticism was, of course, its subjective character, whose non-rational and even inexplicable tendencies were towards the singular, the individual, the momentary experience of participation in the divine. All of Massignon's extraordinary work on mysticism was thus an attempt to describe the itinerary of souls out of the limiting consensus imposed on them by the Orthodox Islamic community, or Sunnah. An Iranian mystic was more intrepid than an Arab one, partly because he was Aryan. The old 19th century labels Aryan and Semitic have a compelling urgency for Massignon, as does also the legitimacy of Schlegel's binary opposition between the two language families, and partly because he was a man seeking the perfect. The Arab mystic, in Massignon's view, inclined towards what Vandenberg calls a testimonial monism. The exemplary figure for Massignon was Al-Hallaj, who sought liberation for himself outside the Orthodox community by asking for, and finally getting, the very crucifixion refused by Islam as a whole. Muhammad, according to Massignon, had deliberately rejected the opportunity offered him to bridge the gap separating him from God. Al-Hallaj's achievement was therefore to have achieved a mystical union with God against the grain of Islam. The rest of the Orthodox community lives in a condition of what Massignon calls soif ontologique, ontological thirst. God presents himself to man as a kind of absence, a refusal to be present, yet the devout Muslim's consciousness of his submission to God's will, Islam, gives rise to a jealous sense of God's transcendence and an intolerance of idolatry of any sort. The seat of these ideas, according to Massignon, is the circumcised heart, which, while it is in the grip of its testimonial Muslim fervor, can, as is the case with mystics like Al-Hallaj, also be inflamed with a divine passion or love of God. In either case, God's transcendental unity, Tawhid, is something to be achieved and understood over and over by the devout Muslim, either through testifying to it or through mystic love of God. And this, Massignon wrote in a complex essay, defines the intention of Islam. Clearly, Massignon's sympathies lay with the mystic vocation in Islam, as much for its closeness to his own temperament as a devout Catholic, as for its disrupting influence within the Orthodox body of beliefs. Massignon's image of Islam is of a religion ceaselessly implicated in its refusals, its late coming, with reference to the other Abrahamic creeds, its comparatively barren sense of worldly reality, its massive structures of defense against psychic commotions of the sort practiced by Al-Hallaj and other Sufi mystics, its loneliness as the only remaining oriental religion of the three great monotheisms. But so obviously stern a view of Islam, with its invariant simple, especially for so luxuriant a thought as Massignon's, entailed no deep hostility towards it on his part. In reading Massignon, one is struck by his repeated insistence on the need for complex reading, injunctions whose absolute sincerity it is impossible to doubt. He wrote in 1951 that his kind of Orientalism was ni une manie d'exotisme, ni un reniement de l'Europe, mais une mise au niveau entre nos méthodes de recherche et les traditions vécues d'antiques civilisations. Put into practice in the reading of an Arabic or Islamic text, this kind of Orientalism produced interpretations of an almost overwhelming intelligence. One would be foolish not to respect the sheer genius and novelty of Massignon's mind. Yet, what must catch our attention in his definition of his Orientalism are two phrases, nos méthodes de recherche and les traditions vécues d'antiques civilisations. Massignon saw what he did as the synthesis of two roughly opposed quantities, yet it is the peculiar asymmetry between them that troubles one, and not merely the fact of the opposition between Europe and Orient. Massignon's implication is that the essence of the difference between East and West is between modernity and ancient tradition. And indeed, in his writings on political and contemporary problems, which is where one can see most immediately the limitations of Massignon's method, the East-West opposition turns up in a most peculiar way. At its best, Massignon's vision of the East-West encounter assigned great responsibility to the West for its invasion of the East, its colonialism, its relentless attacks on Islam. Massignon was a tireless fighter on behalf of Muslim civilization, and as his numerous essays and letters after 1948 testify, in support of Palestinian refugees, in the defense of Arab, Muslim, and Christian rights in Palestine against Zionism, against what, with reference to something said by Abba Ibn, he scathingly called Israeli bourgeois colonialism. Yet the framework in which Massignon's vision was held also assigned the Islamic Orient to an essentially ancient time, and the West to modernity. Like Robertson Smith, Massignon considered the Oriental to be not a modern man, but a Semite. This reductive category had a powerful grip on his thought. When, for example, in 1960, he and Jacques Berck, his colleague at the Collège de France, published their dialogue on the Arabs in Esprit, a good deal of the time was spent in arguing whether the best way to look at the problems of the contemporary Arabs was simply to say, in the main instance, that the Arab-Israeli conflict was really a Semitic problem. Berck tried to demur gently and to nudge Massignon towards the possibility that, like the rest of the world, the Arabs had undergone what he called an anthropological variation. Massignon refused the notion out of hand. His repeated efforts to understand and report on the Palestine conflict, for all their profound humanism, never really got past the quarrel between Isaac and Ishmael, or, so far as his quarrel with Israel was concerned, the tension between Judaism and Christianity. When Arab cities and villages were captured by the Zionists, it was Massignon's religious sensibilities that were offended. Europe, and France in particular, were seen as contemporary realities. Partly because of his initial political encounter with the British during the First World War, Massignon retained a pronounced dislike of England and English policy. Lawrence and his type represented a too complex policy, which he, Massignon, opposed in his dealings with Faisal. Je cherchais avec Faisal, a pénétré dans le sens même de sa tradition à lui. The British seemed to represent expansion in the Orient, amoral economic policy, and an outdated philosophy of political influence. The Frenchman was a more modern man, who was obliged to get from the Orient what he had lost in spirituality, traditional values, and the like. Massignon's investment in this view came, I think, by way of the entire 19th century tradition of the Orient as therapeutic for the West, a tradition whose earliest adumbration is to be found in Quinet. In Massignon, it was joined to a sense of Christian compassion. So far as Orientals are concerned, we ought to have recourse to this science of compassion, to this participation, even in the construction of their language and of their mental structure, in which indeed we must participate. Because ultimately, this science bears witness either to verities that are ours too, or else to verities that we have lost and must regain. Finally, because in a profound sense everything that exists is good in some way, and those poor colonized people do not exist only for our purposes, but in and for themselves. En soi. Nevertheless, the Oriental, en soi, was incapable of appreciating or understanding himself. Partly because of what Europe had done to him, he had lost his religion and his philosophie. Muslims had un vide immense within them. They were close to anarchy and suicide. It became France's obligation, then, to associate itself with the Muslims' desire to defend their traditional culture, the rule of their dynastic life, and the patrimony of believers. No scholar, not even a Massignon, can resist the pressures on him of his nation or of the scholarly tradition in which he works. In a great deal of what he said of the Orient and its relationship with the Occident, Massignon seemed to refine and yet to repeat the ideas of other French Orientalists. We must allow, however, that the refinements, the personal style, the individual genius, may finally supersede the political restraints operating impersonally through tradition and through the national ambiance. Even so, in Massignon's case, we must also recognize that in one direction, his ideas about the Orient remained thoroughly traditional and Orientalist, their personality and remarkable eccentricity notwithstanding. According to him, the Islamic Orient was spiritual, Semitic, tribalistic, radically monotheistic, un-Aryan. The adjectives resemble a catalogue of late 19th century anthropological descriptions. The relatively earthbound experiences of war, colonialism, imperialism, economic oppression, love, death, and cultural exchange seem always, in Massignon's eyes, to be filtered through metaphysical, ultimately dehumanized lenses. They are Semitic, European, Oriental, Occidental, Aryan, and so on. The categories structured his world and gave what he said a kind of deep sense, to him, at least. In the other direction, among the individual and immensely detailed ideas of the scholarly world, Massignon maneuvered himself into a special position. He reconstructed and defended Islam against Europe on the one hand, and against its own orthodoxy on the other. This intervention, for it was that, into the Orient as animator and champion, symbolized his own acceptance of the Orient's difference, as well as his efforts to change it into what he wanted. Both together, the will to knowledge over the Orient and on its behalf, in Massignon, are very strong. His Al-Hallaj represents that will perfectly. The disproportionate importance accorded to Al-Hallaj by Massignon signifies, first, the scholar's decision to promote one figure above his sustaining culture, and second, the fact that Al-Hallaj had come to represent a constant challenge, even an irritant, to the Western Christian, for whom belief was not, and perhaps could not be, the extreme self-sacrifice it was for the Sufi. In either case, Massignon's Al-Halej was intended literally to embody, to incarnate, values essentially outlawed by the main doctrinal system of Islam, a system that Massignon himself described mainly in order to circumvent it with Al-Halej. Nevertheless, we need not say immediately of Massignon's work that it was perverse, or that its greatest weakness was that it misrepresented Islam as an average or common Muslim might adhere to the faith. A distinguished Muslim scholar has argued precisely for this last position, although his argument did not name Massignon as an offender. Much as one may be inclined to agree with such theses, since, as this book has tried to demonstrate, Islam has been fundamentally misrepresented in the West, the real issue is whether indeed there can be a true representation of anything, or whether any and all representations, because they are representations, are embedded first in the language, and then in the culture, institutions, and political ambiance of the representer. If the latter alternative is the correct one, as I believe it is, then we must be prepared to accept the fact that a representation is, eo ipso, implicated, intertwined, embedded, interwoven with a great many other things besides the truth, which is itself a representation. What this must lead us to, methodologically, is to view representations or misrepresentations, the distinction is at best a matter of degree, as inhabiting a common field of play defined for them, not by some inherent common subject matter alone, but by some common history, tradition, universe of discourse. Within this field, which no single scholar can create, but which each scholar receives and in which he then finds a place for himself, the individual researcher makes his contribution. Such contributions, even for the exceptional genius, are strategies of redisposing material within the field. Even the scholar who unearths a once-lost manuscript produces the found text in a context already prepared for it, for that is the real meaning of finding a new text. Thus, each individual contribution first causes changes within the field and then promotes a new stability, in the way that on a surface covered with 20 compasses, the introduction of a 21st will cause all the others to quiver, then to settle into a new accommodating configuration. The representations of Orientalism in European culture amount to what we can call a discursive consistency, one that has not only history, but material and institutional presence to show for itself. As I said in connection with Renan, such a consistency was a form of cultural praxis, a system of opportunities for making statements about the Orient. My whole point about this system is not that it is a misrepresentation of some Oriental essence, in which I do not for a moment believe, but that it operates as representations usually do, for a purpose, according to a tendency, in a specific historical, intellectual, and even economic setting. In other words, representations have purposes. They are effective much of the time. They accomplish one or many tasks. Representations are formations, or as Roland Barthes has said of all the operations of language, they are deformations. The Orient, as a representation in Europe, is formed or deformed out of a more and more specific sensitivity towards a geographical region called the East. Specialists in this region do their work on it, so to speak, because in time their profession as Orientalists requires that they present their society with images of the Orient, knowledge about it, insight into it. And to a very large extent, the Orientalist provides his own society with representations of the Orient, A, that bear his distinctive imprint, B, that illustrate his conception of what the Orient can or ought to be, C, that consciously contest someone else's view of the Orient, D, that provide Orientalist discourse with what, at that moment, it seems most in need of, and E, that respond to certain cultural, professional, national, political, and economic requirements of the epoch. It will be evident that even though it will never be absent, the role of positive knowledge is far from absolute. Rather, knowledge, never raw, unmediated, or simply objective, is what the five attributes of Orientalist representation listed above distribute and redistribute. Seen in such a way, Massignon is less a mythologized genius than he is a kind of system for producing certain kinds of statements, disseminated into the large mass of discursive formations that together make up the archive or cultural material of his time. I do not think that we dehumanize Massignon if we recognize this, nor do we reduce him to being subject to vulgar determinism. On the contrary, we will see, in a sense, how a very human being had, and was able to acquire more of, a cultural and productive capacity that had an institutional or extra-human dimension to it. And this, surely, is what the finite human being must aspire to if he is not to be content with his merely mortal presence in time and space. When Massignon said, "Nous sommes tous des sémites," he was indicating the range of his ideas over his society, showing the extent to which his ideas about the Orient could transcend the local anecdotal circumstances of a Frenchman and of French society. The category of Semite drew its nourishment out of Massignon's Orientalism, but its force derived from its tendency to extend out of the confines of the discipline, out into a broader history and anthropology, where it seemed to have a certain validity and power. On one level at least, Massignon's formulations and his representations of the Orient did have a direct influence, if not an unquestioned validity, among the guild of professional Orientalists. As I said above, Gibbs' recognition of Massignon's achievement constitutes an awareness that, as an alternative to Gibbs' own work, by implication, that is, Massignon was to be dealt with. I am, of course, imputing things to Gibbs' obituary that are there only as traces, not as actual statements, but they are obviously important if we look now at Gibbs' own career as a foil for Massignon's. Albert Hourani's memorial essay on Gibb for the British Academy, to which I have referred several times, admirably summarizes the man's career, his leading ideas, and the importance of his work. With Hourani's assessment, in its broad lines, I have no disagreement. Yet something is missing from it, although this lack is partly made up for in a lesser piece on Gibb, William Polk's Sir Hamilton Gibb Between Orientalism and History. Hourani tends to view Gibb as the product of personal encounters, personal influences, and the like, whereas Polk, who is far less subtle in his general understanding of Gibb than Hourani, sees Gibb as the culmination of a specific academic tradition, what, to use an expression that does not occur in Polk's prose, we can call an academic research consensus or paradigm. Borrowed in this rather gross fashion from Thomas Kuhn, the idea has a worthwhile relevance to Gibb, who, as Hourani reminds us, was in many ways a profoundly institutional figure. Everything that Gibb said or did, from his early career at London to the middle years at Oxford, to his influential years as director of Harvard's Center for Middle Eastern Studies, bears the unmistakable stamp of a mind operating with great ease inside established institutions. Massignon was irremediably the outsider, Gibb the insider. Both men, in any case, achieved the very pinnacle of prestige and influence in French and Anglo-American Orientalism, respectively. The Orient for Gibb was not a place one encountered directly. It was something one read about, studied, wrote about within the confines of learned societies, the university, the scholarly conference. Like Massignon, Gibb boasted of friendships with Muslims, but they seemed, like Lane's, to have been useful friendships, not determining ones. Consequently, Gibb is a dynastic figure within the academic framework of British and later of American Orientalism, a scholar whose work quite consciously demonstrated the national tendencies of an academic tradition, set inside universities, governments, and research foundations. One index of this is that in his mature years, Gibb was often to be met with speaking and writing for policy-determining organizations. In 1951, for instance, he contributed an essay to a book significantly entitled The Near East and the Great Powers, in which he tried to explain the need for an expansion in Anglo-American programs of Oriental studies. The whole situation of the Western countries in regard to the countries of Asia and Africa has changed. We can no longer rely on that factor of prestige which seems to play a large part in pre-war thinking. Neither can we any longer expect the peoples of Asia and Africa or of Eastern Europe to come to us and learn from us while we sit back. We have to learn about them, so that we can learn to work with them in a relationship that is closer to terms of mutuality. The terms of this new relationship were spelled out later in Area Studies Reconsidered. Oriental studies were to be thought of not so much as scholarly activities, but as instruments of national policy towards the newly independent and possibly intractable nations of the post-colonial world. Armed with a refocused awareness of his importance to the Atlantic Commonwealth, the Orientalist was to be the guide of policymakers, of businessmen, of a fresh generation of scholars. What counted most in Gibb's later vision was not the Orientalist's positive work as a scholar. For example, the kind of scholar Gibb had been in his youth when he studied the Muslim invasions of Central Asia, but its adaptability for use in the public world. Hurani puts this well. It became clear to him, Gibb, that modern governments and elites were acting in ignorance or rejection of their own traditions of social life and morality, and that their failures sprang from this. Henceforth, his main efforts were given to the elucidation, by careful study of the past, of the specific nature of Muslim society and the beliefs and culture which lay at the heart of it. Even this problem he tended to see at first, mainly in political terms. Yet, no such later vision could have been possible without a fairly rigorous amount of preparation in Gibb's earlier work, and it is there that we must first seek to understand his ideas. Among Gibb's earliest influences was Duncan MacDonald, from whose work Gibb clearly derived the concept that Islam was a coherent system of life, a system made coherent not so much by the people who led that life as by virtue of some body of doctrine, method of religious practice, idea of order in which all the Muslim people participated. Between the people and Islam, there was obviously a dynamic encounter of sorts, yet what mattered to the Western student was the supervening power of Islam to make intelligible the experiences of the Islamic people, not the other way around. For MacDonald and subsequently for Gibb, the epistemological and methodological difficulties of Islam as an object, about which large, extremely general statements could be made, are never tackled. MacDonald, for his part, believed that in Islam one could perceive aspects of a still more portentous abstraction, the Oriental mentality. The entire opening chapter of his most influential book, whose importance for Gibb cannot be minimized, The Religious Attitude and Life in Islam, is an anthology of unarguable declaratives about the Eastern or Oriental mind. He begins by saying that, "It is plain, I think, and admitted, that the conception of the unseen is much more immediate and real to the Oriental than to the Western peoples. the large modifying elements which seem, from time to time, almost to upset the general law, do not upset it, nor do they upset the other equally sweeping and general laws governing the Oriental mind. The essential difference in the Oriental mind is not credulity.